the latest news and resources about keeping your mind free. Welcome to Live Radio for the Creatively Maladjusted. I am host David Oakes. I am a psychiatric survivor. We are free and broadcasting live Wednesday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. We have a special guest on today's show who is waiting in the wings to be interviewed. He's a real hero of mine and of a lot of people. Jim Gottstein, psychiatric survivor, Harvard-trained lawyer, activist, whistleblower, founder of the group Psych Rights. Lots of news about lots of activities and actions that he's involved in, and I'm looking forward to getting the latest. Your calls and comments and questions are welcome. In a few minutes, I will be giving phone numbers for you to call in live and ask your questions and make comments with Jim. And at any time, you can always email in your questions and comments at radio@mindfreedom.org, radio@mindfreedom.org. So protect yourself and your loved ones from the latest trends in the psychiatric system. Who are some of the leaders in changing the mental health system? Where are safe alternatives in mental health care? I direct Mind Freedom International, a nonprofit group working for human rights and mental health. We're at mindfreedom.org. Let's start with some news. I have some great news from three different cities, from the great cities of Toronto, Montreal, and Cork, Ireland. This Mother's Day, just a few days ago, Mother's Day, May 13th, 2007, there were protests about electroshock. And we have some reports in from Mary Maddock in Ireland, Cork, Ireland. Mind Freedom Ireland held a protest there. And also in Toronto, a whole lot of folks held protests there. And also Montreal. Mary said that this was the first ever public demonstration against electroshock. It's also known as electroconvulsive therapy and ECT. And they were in Daunt Square there in Cork. Mind Freedom organized this, and they have an ongoing campaign. The focus of this Mother's Day protest was that moms and grandmothers are often the target of the shock doctors. More than twice as many women as men are subjected to electroshock, sometimes three times as many women as men in some studies. And the majority of women who get this electroshock tend to be over 60, so elder women are in the crosshairs. They got some good coverage in the Irish Times, way to go. And John McCarthy, who's running for office, psychiatric survivor, he was there. Both John and Mary have been guests here on this show. Toronto, they estimate about 140 folks marched down the streets saying, "Stop shocking our mothers and grandmothers," and they were at Queen's Park. Bonnie Burstow especially helped do organizing on that. And they had these wonderful, large, high signs that they carried in the march, very colorful. And you can see photographs of that at mindfreedom.org. In Montreal, Elaine Grambois, an attorney and psychiatric survivor, helped with the organizing there. Elaine has been an activist for many years challenging electroshock. And they had about 40 people, and that reached a lot of folks. They had good weather. Ireland had horrible weather. The folks in Montreal, I love this, they created these hats, these umbrella hats, you know, that you wear on your head, kind of a novelty umbrella hat. And they put anti-electroshock slogans on those umbrella hats, you know, like protecting their heads from electroshock. And they had drums and a petition and songs in French against electroshock. So way to go, those three cities. It's good to know that electroshock protest is alive and well. San Francisco held some electroshock protests in the last year or two. Just hitting the streets nonviolently and directly reaching the public, that's a great thing. Meanwhile, here's some more good news. The media, major media, has really been pounding psychiatric drugging of kids. Both the New York Times and USA Today this month, May 2007, have run really major investigations about the rapidly increasing prescription of the psychiatric drugs, especially the neuroleptics. People listening to the show know those are the so-called antipsychotics. They used to be called Thorazine, Stelazine, Meloril, Novane, Prolixin. Now they're Clozapine, Risperdal, Abilify. We just got a call here in the office from a guy on forced Abilify on an outpatient basis. So it's going on right now. Well, they've been targeting kids, targeting especially young people. And the New York Times showed that a lot of the doctors who are prescribing these neuroleptics to kids are also getting kickbacks, getting money for lectures, consulting from the drug manufacturers. Of course, they claim, the psychiatrists claim that there's no link between their getting this money and their increased prescribing. But the New York Times pointed out that that's often an, guess what, unconscious process, that when people get a bunch of money, they tend to change their behavior and may not even have any insight into it. Surprise, surprise, psychiatrists are human beings. So New York Times really nailed them on that. And then USA Today also ran a major series, actually, a whole bunch of articles on one day about hazards of psychiatric drugs. We took this opportunity to point out that New York State has a brochure promoting neuroleptics like Haldol for three-year-olds. We were alerted to this brochure. It is still up on the website for Office of Mental Health. I am looking at it right here. Now, we got an anonymous phone call after we put out this alert asking people to contact the governor of New York. We got an anonymous phone call that said, watch that brochure. We think that it'll be coming down really soon. Well, I'm looking at it right here. Still there, folks. Still on the website. We'll continue to look. I appreciate the anonymous call. They said that deep within the New York mental health system, there's been some discussion. You know, there's a new governor in New York, right, this year, and this brochure carries the old governor's name. So there they are, New York Times running an article about the horrible pushing of psychiatric drugs on kids, and there's the New York State mental health system using taxpayer money to endorse giving Haldol to a three-year-old. Hey, folks, I have had Haldol. I know what it's like. I know what it feels like, and that's what the public tends not to hear, what it feels like on the sharp end of the needle. It does not feel good. Hey, good news here. Ben Hansen has hit a real home run on the whole psychiatric drugging of kids issues. We've had Ben Hansen as a guest, kind of like a who's who here. And, you know, if you have other guest suggestions, let us know, because we're really getting some great guests. Well, Ben has been blowing the whistle about psychiatric drugging of kids, and he's been obtaining the statistics about how many kids are being given drugs like the neuroleptics using taxpayer money. So the newspaper Northern Express featured Ben and his challenge to the psychiatric drugging. He's using Freedom of Information Act requests to get this information out over there in Traverse City, Michigan. And so they've had a nice little article there about these chemical cocktails being given to kids. That's multiple psychiatric drugs, a big variety of psychiatric drugs. And in fact, the number of adults taking three or more psych drugs increased by 68% in Michigan in just within 6 months last year. Isn't that incredible? So these are the kind of numbers that Ben has been surfacing. Way to go, Ben. The Michigan activism that Ben has been doing has been able to also look into other states about how other states have had programs where people get funding from the drug companies. The state gets funding from the drug companies supposedly to lower the cost of psychiatric drugging, and gee, guess what? It increases the amount of psychiatric drugging going on there and the amount of money. This just out, Michael Moore's documentary on healthcare, called Sicko, is moving forward toward release, so that's exciting. I'm looking forward to seeing that. We have people say, hey, have you contacted Michael Moore? Oh, yeah, you bet we have. Now, we're on the Gary Null radio network here. Gary Null has actually had Michael Moore in his movies on mental health, and Michael Moore has spoken out on those. So believe me, Michael Moore is very well aware of this. So June 29th is the rollout date for this movie Sicko. That's going to be a big deal, so watch for that. I'd like to get our guest on because he has a lot of information about challenging the mental health system. And even though we have all this good news going on, one really great piece of good news is Jim Gottstein is fighting psychiatric abuse. Jim, like me, we're both survivors of Harvard. I was a working class kid going to Harvard, and Jim is a survivor of Harvard Law School. He grew up in Anchorage, Alaska, and also we have in common that we were both here in Eugene. He went to the University of Oregon. So Jim has been practicing law for more than 25 years there in Alaska. He's a psychiatric survivor who's spent the last two decades fighting human rights abuse in the mental health system. He won attention by blowing the whistle on Eli Lilly, and that was in the New York Times. We're not going to focus on that. We focused on that on other shows. And because that's in the courts, let's ask Jim about a lot of the other activity he's doing today, and we'll be giving those numbers soon. For instance, one of his cases, Alaska Mental Health Trust litigation, resulted in a settlement of $1 billion. That was really famous a number of years ago. So let's bring Jim on board. Jim, hey, welcome.
Thank you, David. It's my pleasure to be here.
Yeah. So what's hot right now in Alaska, other than the greenhouse effect? What's hot in terms of fighting the mental health system for you?
Well, I think we've got this whole strategic litigation campaign going, and we've won the first two cases, and we have some others lined up. But the whole effort is really focused on giving people non-coercive options. So the litigation is really used as a tool or mechanism to kind of force the system into creating these kind of options. And we've made quite a bit of progress.
Can you give me a specific example? I mean, when people hear strategic litigation, they you know, their eyes may glaze. So let's get down to the brass tacks. What can you give me an example of what that means in the real world?
Yeah, in Alaska, the Alaska statutes basically say if someone's dragged into the hospital and the hospital wants to drug them, if the person is found, quote, incompetent to decide not to take them, then the hospital gets to do whatever they want. And we said, no, that's not constitutional. The state can't do that unless it can really prove that it's in the person's best interest, and there's no less restrictive alternative or less intrusive alternative. And so we won that case. It's the Myers case last fall or last summer. And so that really sets up the legal right that people have the right to have another choice. And so that's an example of strategic litigation.
Let's hop around a little bit in terms of choice. One thing that a lot of people are excited about is your work with Soteria House Alaska, which would be creating an alternative to this kind of drug force approach based on a model that Lauren Mosher helped create, a hero for both of us, psychiatrist who created a non-drug alternative. Can you tell us about Soteria Alaska and what's going on with that?
Yes, that's what I was referring to. And what's happened in the last year is the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, which was this agency created out of this other litigation you mentioned, has put some money behind Soteria Alaska, which is to be really a program that follows the original Soteria program, and I can describe that a little bit. But it's basically an alternative to hospitalization. And where the legislative session is going to end tomorrow, I think, and we're probably not going to get funding for that. The Trust Authority recommended that the state put in really a pretty small amount to actually get it open next year, and that can kind of fell through the cracks, but it's looking pretty good for next year, and it may be the trust will just put up enough money to get it open.
Well, I know you did get money for Choices, which is a non-coercive community program run by peers last year, which would be doing... Well, tell us about Choices. What's going on with that?
Well, Choices stands for Consumers Having Ownership in Creating Effective Services. And I really don't like the term consumers, but I like that acronym for Choices.
Yeah.
And it's really meant to be an alternative community mental health center that focuses on what people want, you know, their choices. And that might include drugs, but it very definitely includes support for not taking drugs. And so you could look at Soteria as being an alternative to hospitalization and Choices being an alternative in the community. And there's really different sets of people involved. For example, Soteria is really designed to get people who have not been on neuroleptics, either any or not very long, and find those people that can get better without them and get on with their lives. And we know that what the system is doing is at least doubling, probably tripling, the number of people who don't recover from mental illness. And find the people that really are just going through a temporary phase or temporary problems and focus on those problems and allow them to really escape from what I call the mental illness system. And so when you think about funding, for example, we looked at Medicaid, and then we decided, well, Medicaid makes no sense, because to get onto Medicaid, you have to be certified that you're going to be permanently disabled. And that's exactly what we don't want to track people into, which is what the current system does. So continuing then, Choices, on the other hand, is for people that have been in the system longer, need continuing help, and those people tend to be on Medicaid, so Medicaid would be a...
So I want to make sure to mention that you are president of NARPA, the National Association for Rights, Protection, and Advocacy. NARPA, could you mention a bit about NARPA, and also you have a gathering this fall. Maybe you can mention that.
Yes, NARPA, which, as you said, stands for the National Association for Rights, Protection, and Advocacy, is composed of primarily psychiatric survivors and lawyers doing rights work. And we have an annual conference, and this year it's November 14th through the 17th in Los Angeles. So it's on the West Coast this year. It's really, I think, as good a conference as I've ever been to. They tend to be really...
Well, I've always enjoyed going there. It really, I love it because it mixes activism and the law. I mean, it's important for the lawyers to get together, but it's nice to have room for the activists, so I appreciate it.
Yes, and I think it's very important for the lawyers to really hear from the survivors about what's really going on, because lots of times lawyers really have a way of looking at things that really tends not to matter that much.
Jim, I wonder if I've struck some of the big ones. Then you have the strategic litigation going on. You've got the Soteria House getting pushing for that. Maybe it'll be next year. And then you have the Choices program you're working on, and also NARPA. Did I miss any biggies?
Well, there's also ICSPP, which is the International Center for the Study of Psychiatry and Psychology. And that's the group started by Dr. Peter Breggin, who's a hero to so many of us who
Right. Well, let's talk about that. I understand. You and I were both on a teleconference with ICSPP folks and also Mind Freedom folks and Psych Rights folks about dealing with the psychiatric drugging issue. Do you want to mention anything about that?
Well, I think, the conference, ICSPP conference, is going to be focused on kids, the drugging of kids. And,
right.
And that's, I think, probably, you mentioned that on your intro, and that, I think, is the most horrific part of this whole system that's going on, and what we're doing to a generation of kids with all this psychiatric drugging is.
Right, and the system just wants to address rehearsal for the to drug the African kids and Asian kids and South American kids. Let's talk a bit about what's on the news this past less than a month, which is the Cho massacre in Virginia Tech. What's been the fallout from your angle? What do you take away from this huge event in terms of our work in changing the mental health system?
Well, I think, there's been kind of this frenzy about we need to make it easier to force people to take their drugs, which is exactly the wrong response for all kinds of reasons. And I think that's very unfortunate. Nobody's really looked at things and to really recognize that if you look at this situation, it's very clear that Cho is a failure of the mental illness system.
Right. We do have a question that came in by email. I want to give the phone numbers, though, for people to call in questions. So get a pen handy. We have a USA toll-free number, and we also have an international phone number. Please keep trying. Sometimes you might get a busy signal or have reach voicemail. But if you do try, you do get in. We have successfully had callers. So let's hear comments or questions. The toll-free number in the USA is 1-888-873-4643. That's 1-888-873-4643. And if you're outside of the United States, you can call 1-646-307-4494, 1-646-307-4494. You can give a comment, a question. You can thank Jim for his great work that he's doing here, fighting for human rights in the mental health system. And you can let people know that we have folks out there. The archives, by the way, are working again. I know for a while they were not, but for the last few weeks there's a new web page up there. You can get all this information and more at mindfreedom.org to find out how to get the archives. I know more people listen to the archives than listen live. But let's get this emailed question to you, Jim, from Karen in Oregon, actually. Karen emails to say, I just wanted to say that Mr. Gottstein is a hero of mine. Well, I'd agree with that. I am so looking forward to his thoughts on the recent flurry of great news stories about the drugging of our children. And I wanted to remind David that there are no protections for consumers of mental health services out there. Karen, I'm familiar with Karen's story, actually. She's a mom. And so she writes, the Oregon Board of Psychologists Examiners received 293 consumer complaints from the year 2000 to the year 2004. So that's almost 300 consumer complaints during a five-year period. But only 13 of those 293 resulted in any type of disciplinary action. I have all the stats if you want them. Yeah, Karen, I heard her testify in the state legislature. She filed a complaint about abuse by a psychologist of her daughter and found out that only, as she said, 13 out of about 300 complaints had any kind of discipline, which is way lower than most professions. Do you want to comment on that, about going after licenses of these abusive psychiatrists and psychologists?
Well, I think that the one really important point, well, there's a lot of important points that she's made, but from my perspective, what I've found is that there's this attitude of two things, completely ignoring what consumers say or psych survivors or mental patients, whatever we want to call them, because there's just this idea, oh, this person is crazy, they're delusional, and therefore we won't pay any attention to them. And it really is a breeding ground for all kinds of abuse. And the other is that people's rights tend to be ignored as a matter of course. They're just automatically ignored. And so that's kind of the setting that we have in this. I think that professional organizations tend to, you know, protect their members through these processes. I think it's worthwhile to bring these kind of complaints, and I think that it's very helpful to have some other person that's an advocate alongside one to help bring these complaints. And they're much more difficult to dismiss out of hand that way. And also, one should really continue to pursue them through all the levels, if at all possible. When Psych Rights, for example, takes cases, we're always looking at any case or every case being a potential appeal, because that's really where you make changes.
Well, let's talk about your backstory, your recruitment in this. How old were you when you first got into the mental health system yourself, Jim?
I was 29 years old.
29, okay. So yeah. You're pretty darn young there. And diagnosis?
Well, I've had different diagnoses. I wasn't in that long, so I didn't accumulate as many as some, but I was originally discharged with what was called atypical psychosis, but then later given a diagnosis of bipolar disorder.
Hey, we have a caller from Pennsylvania, Karen from Pennsylvania. Welcome aboard. You got a comment or question for Jim?
Hello?
Hi, Karen. Welcome to Mind Freedom News Hour. You're on the air. Do you have a comment or question for Jim?
Yes, I have a question. If you feel you were abused within a hospital, I was hospitalized twice in July, and I've written letters, well, that the patient advocate from NAMI told me were the appropriate people, and I really feel as if nothing's been done. If there's more I can do, like possibly write to the board of directors, or what more, how much further do you think I can pursue this?
Well, you need to, or you can look at what the actual procedures are and how far you can bump them up, and it varies from state to state, organization to organization, but many times grievances can get bumped up to the board of directors, and maybe, you know, you can even maybe go farther, although that tends to be expensive. Another thing that I think exposure is also potentially very valuable, to the extent that someone's willing to try and get media attention about it, that's good. And Psych Rights has a page on its website, and our website is psychrights.org, psychrights.org. We have a page called Everyday Horrors of the Mental Health System. And so people submit their stories, and we post them, and we really have quite a collection of these horror stories, and you know, and people read them. So that's, you know, not as good as getting media coverage or actually getting the agency to change. There's also a lot of states will have what might be called an ombudsman, where you can complain about organizations from outside, you know, to someone that's not part of the organization.
And
okay. That might be an avenue to.
Karen, may I ask what, in a nutshell, happened there in Pennsylvania, if you'll pardon the good old male patient pun here, what in a nutshell happened there? I mean, were you forcibly drugged? Were you committed?
Yeah, I was forcibly drugged. The main problem was I was subdued. I was locked away. I was yelled at by people. I had one of the orderlies mistakenly believed I had stolen another patient's bed and got very angry and got in my face and started yelling and kind of stuff along that line. Also yelled at by a nurse and told by a nurse that I wouldn't have been there if I had God in my life and stuff like that.
Well, do you want to say the name of the institution?
Yes, it's Mill Creek Community Hospital in Erie, Pennsylvania.
Did
and they're just
adding
an electroshock machine.
Really?
Adding a fourth floor, or fifth floor, I think.
Yeah, so the money's pouring in over there, huh? Did you
say
Mill Creek?
Mill Creek, it's all one word, Mill Creek Community Hospital.
M-I-L-L-C-R-E-E-K?
Right.
And so you sounds like you've taken some action since you were locked up in July. You filed complaints?
Well, I didn't actually file a grievance. I contacted the patient advocate. We have a local chapter of NAMI, and I wrote letters to what she said were the appropriate people. And I'm not sure if the letter got to the CEO. I did try to call the CEO, but they have a problem with former mental patients contacting her, so they're a little bit protective of her. So I never really knew if she got the story or not.
I'm looking at the Mill Creek website here. It's a small area. They say they have 55 people on psychiatric wards there. So I don't know if that's accurate or not, but they actually have a list of Mill Creek Township in Erie County, Pennsylvania. I'd encourage you to be active with Psych Rights and with Mind Freedom. Anybody that's been abused by the mental health system, you know, to speak out. We also do publish abuse stories here, too.
MindFreedom.org?
MindFreedom.org. Are you out of the closet about what happened to you, or are you keeping private about it?
A little bit of both. You know, I have no problem signing my name to the letters that I sent. I had no problem contacting NAMI, but I'll be truthful. A lot of my friends and family don't know.
Yeah. Jim, what about that issue of privacy and fighting the system? I mean, you and I were out of the closet as people diagnosed psychotic, but you know, most people, they're not out of the closet on that one. How have you dealt with that whole issue about coming out, and has it negatively affected your family relationships?
Well, first I want to say I think that it can be very harmful to be open about that, and so I never criticize or think badly about anybody who wants to keep that private. I have kind of a privileged life and in a lot of ways couldn't be hurt by being open about it the way most people can. So it hasn't affected me that much. But it's interesting. I had a talk with someone maybe a year ago who mentioned that people still talk about it behind my back. Oh, that's Gottstein, you know, he was in the hospital, you know, psychiatric hospital, and da 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 da. And that was in 1982 that I was in the hospital, 25 years ago. So it really is something that can carry around with you.
Right, it is. Yeah, that is a challenge to come out publicly about it. I really appreciate Karen's call from Pennsylvania and speaking out about, it sounds like humiliation and trauma on the part of the mental health system there, with being yelled at and so forth and so on. And so, Jim, you were telling me a little bit about your origin story there. Tell me a little bit more about that. I mean, what do you think triggered you first getting locked up? I mean, what do you think the precipitating issue was?
Well, I had a lot of stuff going on in my life, and I have a pattern that can happen where if I have a lot of work and I've got a deadline and I've got a lot of things to work out in terms of basically thinking about it, I can't stop thinking about it, and I don't, you know, I can't sleep because I'm thinking about it, and if I go that too long, then I'll become psychotic. Well, the first time it happened, I had no idea that could happen to me. And so I ended up jumping out of the second floor window in my underwear about, I don't know, 3 in the morning, which was actually light in Alaska. It was in June. I knew how to do a parachute landing fall and didn't think I'd hurt myself, and I did a perfect parachute landing fall and didn't hurt myself. But so I got dragged into the hospital and all that. So
we have a call all the way from South Africa, Jim. David, who's a Mind Freedom member in South Africa, is calling in. Welcome aboard, David.
Hi, guys. You probably know I'm the guy from South Africa who drives you crazy, David. I've known you for a while, and Jim, proudly but sadly, only ICSFP member here in South Africa, but we have some great things going on. I just wanted to say all the stuff that you've been talking about is just fantastic. I just wanted to give an outline of a major problem. This is just astonishing.
David? If you can speak a little more clearly and slowly and loudly, all the way from South Africa, we got to make sure we hear you. Go ahead.
Okay. Just to let you know that the influence of the drug companies in a place like South Africa, which is crying out for alternatives, the Sotiraya kind of solution, so to speak, it's just beyond belief. For example, the University of Cape Town in South Africa, they are getting research grants from numerous drug companies, including Eli Lilly. I mean, and we have a situation here where a country like South Africa, with its past and its history and its ethnicity, that, you know, we're being influenced in a country for this. And I really, you know, the if you have any advice or we can spread the word, we're hoping to get a Mad Pride festival this year. And, you know, I just thought to say that, you know, I totally agree with your ideas and on the, you know, it's globalizing of psychiatry with the unholy alliance with the drug companies. And I mean, really, we need some advocacy here in South Africa and also Africa. And, you know, sorry I'm going on, but please, Jim and David,
thank you very much, David, in South Africa. You know, that's a really excellent point about the globalization going on of this psychiatric abuse. I mean, Africa is so in the crosshairs of the psychiatric drug industry. I once heard a psychiatrist brag about a program he's involved in where he said just one psychiatrist can drug 1,000 Africans by training lay people and cutting the pills in half and everything. I mean, do you want to address any of what David brought up or this globalization of the mental health system?
Well, I think that there are two things I'd like to talk about. One is the problem of pharmaceutical company really corruption of the research process is huge. And, so
Jim, could you speak up a little bit?
Yeah, is this better?
Yeah, that's better.
The problem of drug company corruption of the research process is just huge. And so even the articles in the most prestigious journals can really be suspect. The other thing I think that's important, and Vera Shirov is more of an expert on this. I don't know if you've had her on, but you might think about it.
You've got to have Vera on sometime. That's a good suggestion.
And but there's this issue of research subjects. There are, you know, supposedly pretty strict guidelines for who, you know, research because of all the abuses that have taken place. And so companies are going into Africa in order to, where it's a lot easier to get people into these research programs that really can be quite harmful to people.
That's right, looking for guinea pigs out there. That's a really great point. Say, Jim, let me give the numbers again for people to call in. I appreciate the calls here from South Africa and Pennsylvania. There's still time for other people to call in. Get your pen handy. In the USA, it's toll-free. 1-888-873-4643. Or you can always email to radio at mindfreedom.org. So USA, that's 1-888-373-4643. And internationally, like David just called in, 1-646-307-4494. That's 1-646-307-4494. And also anytime at radio at mindfreedom.org, including if you're hearing this on the archives, you're welcome to email radio at mindfreedom.org. I'll forward your email to Jim and try to answer any questions. Hey, Jim, I'm remembering that INTAR, the International Network for Treatment Alternatives for Recovery, it's a little network of people promoting alternatives in the mental health system. They just met not all that far from, kind of in between you and me, up there in Vancouver. Any words from how the INTAR meeting went?
Well, we had a great meeting. There are about 40 of us, and we're making steps to really formalize the relationship or the organization and all that, and really spread the word and promote alternatives for recovery around the world, and not only spread the word, but also gather information from what people are doing around the world, because there are a lot of great things that people are doing around the world. We had people from, we had someone from Germany, we had someone from New Zealand, of course Canada, the U.S., England and Ireland, so it was great, and we're really trying to expand beyond kind of the English-speaking world, and that presents a set of challenges.
Excellent. People can look that up at intar.org, that's INTAR.org, or just Google International Network Toward Alternatives and Recovery. Sorry, I got the name wrong. International Network Toward Alternatives and Recovery. I'll put a plug in. There's still a little bit of space left in July for a conference on alternatives. You can read about it at mindfreedom.org. That's open to the public, and that's on creative revolution and healing. So, Jim, what kind of things do you see happening this coming year, this next 6 months to a year, that are on your horizon? What's the focus of PsychRights and Jim Gottstein and really this whole whirlwind of activity you have going on between NARPA and INTAR and ICSPP and your strategic lawsuits and Choices and Soteria House and did I leave anything out?
Well, I think that's plenty. The thing that I'm most excited about is we were able to hire an executive director. And PsychRights' mission has always been to do this around the country. And our executive director's name is Bruce Whittington, and he's tasked with really trying to set up the same sort of strategic litigation and working with local groups to do that around the country. We've done it in Alaska because I get to sue the bastards here, is the way I say it. You know, I'm licensed to practice law here. And so in other states, I'm not, and plus we need other attorneys. So I'm very excited about working on getting this going in some other states. And,
so what are some of the states where it is happening, and what are some of the states where it'll probably be happening over this next few months or year?
Well, the other thing I want to talk about is this issue of ineffective representation of, and I'll get back to that, of the lawyers assigned to people facing involuntary commitment and forced drugging tend to have this attitude: if my client wasn't crazy, she'd know this was good for her. And then they just basically throw the case. And this is, I think, where the system is most broken. So that's the other big project of PsychRights. We're really looking at Massachusetts as a place because they've got a very good local organization. We've talked about in really California. I don't know if I'm jumping the gun or not, but your board member Ted is moving towards actually forming a PsychRights California as a separate nonprofit, which is terrific, and we expect to be working.
So Massachusetts and California are the ones to watch this coming year?
Those are the ones that we'd really like to see. And we've kind of even before the Cho disaster, tragedy, we were talking with people in Virginia. They've got this mental health commission going that was really kind of this
Let's talk a little bit about that, the law in Cho, which is, we filed a Freedom of Information Act, Mind Freedom Virginia filed a Freedom of Information Act that we wanted to know what psychiatric drugs Cho was on. We want to know about his toxicology report, autopsy report. The medical examiners wrote back saying, sorry, Freedom of Information Act does not include medical records, only the family's permission. We can only get that information out to the public with family permission. But a lot of times the family isn't interested in airing problems about the psychiatric drugging and issues involving the kids. So can you want to talk about that either specifically or generally, that whole issue of secrecy?
This issue of, quote, confidentiality really, I think, has, from my perspective, is a joke from the patient's point of view. Everybody talks about you and all that. In some cases, if you haven't been involved in the system for very long, if you just have a brief interaction with it, maybe it's meaningful. But it's mainly used as a shield by the professionals to keep any light from being shined on what's going on. So having said that, I think that private medical records really are something that's sensitive. I don't know, but it's kind of absurd in the Cho case because of the way that came down with everybody talking about everything and the videos that he had and all that kind of stuff. And so so there's that part of it. And then there's the legal part of it, which is one would have to look and see exactly what the Virginia Freedom of Information Act covers and all that. And normally there's a mechanism to appeal to court, but of course that's you need a lawyer for that, and that tends to be expensive. That's how Ben Hansen had in Michigan has had to go that route for some of the information that he hasn't gotten.
Right. Yeah. So That is difficult on that Freedom of Information Act request. I mean, here in Eugene, we have the case of Ryan Salisbury, 19-year-old, that died in interaction with the police. He ran out of a house with a knife labeled psychiatrically and had a hail of bullets and died, but we still haven't been able to find out what drugs he was on because it takes the signature of the family to release that information. So, it seems to be against the public interest. When I started this work 31 years ago, for the first about 15 years, we could get those autopsy reports. We just asked for them, and as a nonprofit that was interested, they gave them to us. And then suddenly they said, "Oh no, we got to protect their privacy." It's like they're dead. You're protecting whose privacy?
Yeah, so, I think there's a lot to what you're saying, and I don't know enough about it to know if they're legally correct or not about that. And it could very well be that their legal right to privacy ends with their death. It could be that the public interest in their information might outweigh that. And it could be that there are other ways to kind of get the information, like if you had a separate lawsuit. And,
Jim, in terms of your legal expertise, I'm wondering, you might not have had a chance to really look at it in depth, but a lot of people are excited that the United Nations has passed a major treaty about disability rights and are feeling that it could potentially be used internationally on some of these issues. Have you had a chance to look into that, or do you have any thoughts about that?
I have some familiarity with it, and I think that it's a very strong statement, very far-reaching, and I think could be a very important tool for in getting people, for stopping some of this abuse around the world. So I think it's an incredibly important thing that's been done. I'm trying to think how many countries have actually signed on to it. I don't think it's that many so far, is it?
Yeah, I don't know the exact number. I know the USA has not signed off on it. I will be raising this issue myself in Germany in June, the first week of June. I'm working on a public statement with a number of other movement activists and groups where we will bring up that treaty and other issues with the World Psychiatric Association to argue against forced psychiatry. So yeah, let's look at the big picture here. We have a few minutes left. We end about 5 minutes to the hour. Let's look at the big picture here. What vision do you have for like the long term here in terms of changing the mental health system? What would you like to see? What's your vision of, like, if you could wave a magic wand and you had a few billion dollars to play with, what would things look like in 5 or 10 years in terms of the mental health system and the law? How big of a change are you calling for?
Well, I think we really need to absolutely turn the current system on its head. The most important thing, I think, is to public education about the truth of what gets labeled as mental illness, and even more importantly, maybe the truth about the so-called treatments that are really nothing more than brain damage relabeled as treatment, and that there are other alternatives. And I think by doing that, that will encourage more alternatives, these other alternatives. And so there's the education about that. There's the education that these alternatives really help a lot of people and can help them recover. And then the litigation is a way, I think, to help do all of that. But it's really just a mechanism to help people get these alternatives and also help the public understand that they're not being told the truth about what gets labeled as mental illness.
I like your idea of improving the commitment process. I've been to quite a number of commitment hearings, and you often just meet your court-appointed attorney a few minutes beforehand. The court-appointed attorney is often just in the role of somebody who's there over and over and over again, who knows the judge, who knows the person who's seeking the commitment. So, yeah, that would be a big area that needs help.
The commitment and forced drugging process is by far the path of least resistance for this system in the hospitals. It's so easy for them to do, maybe 15 minutes total, including doing all the paperwork, and they get to do whatever they want to someone. So they don't have to try and understand the person. They don't have to try and get their, establish any kind of therapeutic relationship or any kind of human-to-human relationship. They can just force them. And if people had their lawyers that were really working for them and making the state really prove their case, instead of it taking maybe 15 minutes for each case, it would take at least half a day. And if that were to happen, then the system would be looking for other things to do. It would no longer be the path of least resistance. And that's
this is a great vision, and I know that anybody who would be facing a commitment, boy, they sure would be lucky to have a Jim Gottstein on their side. Jim, we're out of time. Thank you, everybody, and thank you, Jim Gottstein, with PsychRights at PsychRights.org, attorney, psychiatric survivor, hero. Thanks to our callers, listeners, Eric in the studio. This is David Oakes with Mind Freedom News Hour at mindfreedom.org every Wednesday at 4 p.m. here. Thanks, everybody.